Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Sponsored by Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by Cybertrust.
Hello and welcome to this late edition of Risky Business, brought to you this week from Melbourne, courtesy of itradio.com.au and TechTarget Australia's searchsecurity.com.au website. I've flown down south to take a tour through NEC's Research and Development HQ in Mulgrave, and chances are if you listen to our networking show, A Series of Tubes, you'll be hearing a report on that in the next few weeks. Now, before I forget to hassle you, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast via iTunes, RSS, or another podcatcher like Zipod or Zencast. You can also sign up for weekly email reminders. Sign up for them by clicking on the link to the right of the posts on the itradio.com.au website. To matters at hand now, this week's show features an interview with Arbor Networks Country Manager in Australia, Nick Race. Arbor is well known for making some seriously heavy-duty, telco-grade DDoS prevention kit, and we chatted to Nick about how it all works. Our sponsor interview this week is with Verizon Business Security Solutions' Andrew Valentine. He'll be telling us how the bad guys have updated their techniques and upgraded their skills to mitigate the effects of the payment card industry data security standard. Andrew's a frontline investigator in many high-profile data loss incidents, so you'll want to hear this one. But first, as always, it's time for a check of ZDNet Australia's news headlines with that company's editor, Mania Katadia.
Mania, Bruce Schneier has taken a leaf from the book of the Department of the Bleedingly Obvious and said, beware of snake oil salesmen in the InfoSec industry.
Yeah, that's right. He was talking in London, wasn't he, at the RSA conference, Europe. And apparently he says you should be worried about which security products you buy because they're not all good. There are apparently some security products out there which don't keep you very secure.
Yeah, he just says you've got to be careful and be really skeptical, you know, caveat emptor, buyer beware, all of that when dealing with security products. But this has been a problem for a long time. I remember, I did actually work in the InfoSec space many, many years ago, and we'd be trying to sell intrusion detection solutions. And we'd come across competitors who were really making promises about their products that were, you know, they were bullshit.
There's been a lot of this. I mean, come on, you can go and buy. I think one of the things that Schneier was saying in the report was that you can have two products. One of them is actually really very good. The other one's almost rubbish. And yet they come out with exactly the same descriptions. And that's the issue there. It's like they're both described with the same marketing bollocks, effectively. But yeah. when you look below the surface, and one of them might be good, the other one might be bad. Well, of course, they could both be rubbish.
Quite often, now that security's become such a big issue, there are people... The people who sign the checks quite often aren't the ones with the technology nous,
yes,
to be able to determine what is technically, you know, the best solution. And mm-hmm. I guess in security, it's particularly important to have a solution that's of a very high technical standard.
Yeah. And I guess really, I mean, come on, you can go and buy the best security products out there and spend the most money and then have default passwords on your systems and none of those really matter. So it is all about covering all the bases.
Symantec and Microsoft have buried the security hatchet, according to a story that came through from ZDNet UK.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting, isn't it? I mean, when Vista came out, we had Symantec all over Microsoft saying, oh, it's rubbish, it's full of holes, and Microsoft saying, yeah, well, you know, your stuff isn't that good either. And now it seems that they've both kind of like got it together here, and they're joining some group, aren't they? It's the Software Assurance Forum for Excellence in Code.
Yeah, I like it.
It's called
like
Safe Code.
The Center for Really Good Things. You know, it's just one of those great names, isn't
yeah.
it? The Center for Mega Happy Fun Software Code.
So we've got these two companies that make the biggest bloaty software joining things, this thing called Safe Code. So now everything's going to be sharp and super cool and not going to be bloaty at all, right?
Yeah, right. And I guess, too, the interesting thing about Symantec, I don't know if you noticed this, but when Microsoft decided to enter the security market, Symantec just dramatically shifted its PR into attack mode. They would regularly get stuck right into Microsoft, which is something they didn't really do beforehand. But it seems that their criticism in this instance has been fair. And, you know, they're making Microsoft share information so that they can continue to be a viable player. And Microsoft, I'm sure, is acutely aware that it doesn't want to be involved in another antitrust action.
Yeah, yeah, I guess. Do you reckon that's why they're doing it? Oh my God, I thought they may actually want to secure people and, you know, make better code. Come on, this is all just more marketing rubbish, isn't it?
Do you think? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think they're giving them better access to APIs and things like that so that third-party security types can come up with, you know, better software.
Oh, God, well, I believe it when I see it.
All right. Well, stand by, risky business listeners. We'll just have to wait and see until Mynir the Cynic over there is satisfied.
Yeah.
Now, we've seen the exploitation of a dangerous PDF file vulnerability. This is newsworthy because it's not just about a vulnerability, but people are actually out there, you know, genuinely exploiting this Adobe Reader flaw that affects version 7 through to 8.1.
Yeah, and apparently you can get done. And what is it, the Russian Business Network?
I love that. It's like how the Mafia used to call themselves. What was it? The Legitimate Businessmen's Association.
That's right. Yeah. So the Russian Business Network is apparently, that's where the exploits are coming from.
Yeah.
And they stick in a couple of rootkits and God knows what else. It's pretty nasty, this is.
Yeah, it is. I mean, at least they didn't call themselves the Fluffy Bunny Organization. Well, there was a hacker called Fluffy Bunny, wasn't there, back in the day?
There was?
Yeah, Fluffy Bunny, he was like defacing everything. I think he eventually got scooped up and charged with a bunch of stuff. But
one of your mates?
Never made his acquaintance, but
well, one of the few, I reckon.
But his logo was this little fluffy bunny with this gigantic it was just so funny. And he used to deface websites with it. And, sorry, I can't be seen to be encouraging that sort of stuff.
No, but, you know, no, sorry about
it. I suppose bad people will be bad, and you know, if they're gonna deface something, at least have a sense of humour about it.
I guess so.
Now, Apple, which just loves to pride itself on its security marketing, has released its latest operating system, Leopard, and they're touting security features. And I've got to say, I've just gone through the list, and they look like good security features, but there's nothing really mind-blowing in there, is there?
There is. I don't know what there is about Leopard. Have you had a play with it yet?
No, I believe, and I've spoken to Apple, and I've asked them if they could actually get a copy for myself and for you, so that we could both have a play around with it, and then, I suppose, compare notes in a couple of weeks on the show.
They've been in touch, and they said they're going to send me a copy, so I will have a play. But no, I've been looking through this list, and there seems to be some stuff in there. Some of it seems oddly, strangely familiar to what we heard from Vista, I think. But
well, library randomization, which is address space layout randomization, which, you know, prevents people from being able to easily guess offsets in exploit code, which is something that, you know, Microsoft put into Vista, which was a really good idea. I mean, it makes stuff a lot harder. They say sandboxing, which is, you know, it's been around in Unix land since the dawn of bloody time. tagging downloads before Leopard will execute a download, it'll ask for your consent first by telling you when a file was downloaded, what application was used, and if applicable, which URL it came from. There's going to be an application-based firewall, which is, you know, again, something we've seen in Vista.
Yeah.
Stronger encryption for disk images, which is, you know, kind of cool, but I don't think many people really use that. Signed applications, that's interesting. All applications for Leopard will be signed by either Apple or third-party developers. Until we see some detail on that or have a play with it, we're not going to know really much more about it. It's a bit of a vague description. There's enhanced VPN client compatibility, multiple user certificates for the one machine, smart card capabilities, and Windows SMB packet signing. So if you're using a Mac on a Windows network, you can enjoy improved compatibility and security with Windows-based servers, according to the folks at, what is it, Cupertino?
Yeah, it's a fairly decent list there. I mean, you know, this was never going to be a huge operating system upgrade, really. And I think that they've had some nice features and nice enhancements there. And I look forward to having a play and seeing what happens.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll revisit that one in a couple of weeks. Great headline, guys. Well done. I don't know if this is one that you came up with, but America continues to spam the world.
Yeah, that was me.
That was you? Well done.
Yes. Yeah, America remains the world's biggest spammer. I mean, can spam. What a waste of time that was. If anything, spam has gone up since they launched their spam laws, hasn't it?
I think spam has indeed gone up, but at the same time, at least it's been outlawed. At least it's driven these guys to an extent underground. And I suppose, you know, while a lot of these spam messages are actually coming from American PCs, they're probably compromised PCs. Who knows where the actual message is originating from? It could be anywhere on the planet. Mm. But I suppose the interesting thing here is, you know, most of the spam you see, it's a lot of it advertises American-made goods.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've really got to go after the people who are making the money out of this thing, not necessarily the people sending the messages.
Yeah. Follow the money, you always get to the right people then.
You know, there is a silver bullet when it comes to spam.
Oh, yeah, go on.
It's to basically ensure that no one on the planet actually buys anything from the spam campaign.
That would do it.
You know, as long as there's money in it, people are going to do it. And, you know, we just need to maybe fines for people. Summary execution for people who buy Viagra via spam messages.
No, don't say it too loud. I know after our last few conversations, Bush actually listens to this now, and you don't want to give him any ideas.
Oh, and I have to say, too, I love Sophos's marketing techniques with this stuff. They call the top 12 spamming nations the Dirty Dozen.
They've been doing this a while. It's a good name.
Yeah, it is a good name, isn't it? It just makes it newsworthy. I mean, it wouldn't be interesting if it was, you know, Trend Micro's 12 most prolific spamming countries.
Yeah, right? Good work on marketing there.
Yeah, Sophos's Dirty Dozen.
It's nice to know that Australia's still down near the bottom. I think we're number 37 or something, and New Zealand's at like 74.
Yeah, I think so, something like that. Yeah. It's, you know, we're not exactly what, but I mean, you can trace spam to any country where there's a load of computers.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and they've got really good connectivity in the States, and pretty much everyone's got a computer. So, you know, that's where the spam's going to come from. I'd worry if we were more than 37. You know, it'd be really interesting to compare that Dirty Dozen ranking to, you know, a ranking of countries by you know, the rate of PC use and connectivity, because I think you'd find a lot of commonality there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I reckon if we did it per capita instead of just overall full country.
Did I just give you an idea for a story?
Maybe.
Excellent.
Let's see what happens.
Get one of your minions on it now that you're the editor.
And now I have loads. It's great.
And by the way, listeners, you can check out these stories on zdnet.com.au/news. And I suppose our final news item this week is our famous fraudster has claimed ID cards like the one proposed by the Liberal government here in Australia actually help criminals.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know how to say his surname. Abagnale?
Abagnale, yeah. I think it is Abagnale. He's the dude who they made Catch Me If You Can about. He was the you know, the old Czech fraudster who actually became a bit of
a... Yeah, the ultimate Czech fraudster. He was brilliant. And basically, he's saying that ID cards actually make it 100 times easier for criminals to steal personal information.
And his logic on this isn't really that much of a stretch, is it? He says, look, if you take everyone's personal information and put it in a central repository, guess what? Not a good idea.
I mean, the one thing he says, all it takes is 1 week civil servant to be bought off, and that's it. The 1 week link basically compromises the whole system, and by putting it all together, you're just, you know, just encouraging it, basically. So stop being such idiots.
And can you imagine how much blanket access to that data store would actually be worth to some people from the Fluffy Bunny Association? The Russian Business Network?
It just piles up, doesn't it? Every time you, like, connect another one of these systems to this ID, then that's it. Its value goes up.
Well, crazy. I can imagine that you could easily scrape together, like, $10 million from investors in the underworld to actually go after a central repository containing the personal information and identity information of virtually every Australian citizen.
Yeah, I don't think that's a crazy price at all. That's just, it just makes sense. I don't know what these people are thinking. They're obviously not thinking security. They've got some other dodgy agenda, and it's not to help us.
Yeah, I think we need to make identities, you know, identities need to be things that are hard to forge and hard to actually, you know, it should be difficult to establish everything about a particular identity through distribution or whatever. So, I don't know, I don't like this ID card thing, and neither does Frank Abagnale. So,
No, good on him, I say.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, he was the crook, he was the one who was probably the most accomplished ID, you know, single ID fraudster out there. I mean, he made millions of dollars out of them. That sort of stuff. So
we talked a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it, about if Labor came into power, then the ID card thing was going to be put on the shelf.
Yeah, they're going to shelve it. They're going to scrap it. But I, you know, it's who knows what's going to happen after this election.
Yeah, but, yeah, we haven't got too long left. It's getting kind of exciting.
Yeah, it is. It is. Okay, Munir. Well, that's it for the news. I mean, there was a lot of it. Thank you as always for joining us.
Thank you, mate. It was a pleasure.
That was ZDNet Australia's editor Munir Kataria there with this week's news. And I looked it up. Fluffy Bunny was the name of a hacking group, not an individual. They were responsible for a number of defacements, as well as having their logo appear as a banner ad on securityfocus.com when they hacked the ad-serving company. Wired News also reported that Fluffy Bunny members considered knocking out the root domain name servers and Akamai, but decided that was too evil. Two of their members were picked up by law enforcement around 2001-2002. So there you go. We'll be right back after this.
How cool would it be to have a complete picture of every event on your network? Collecting and managing all the data across the enterprise through a single platform. Your life in risk management, compliance and security operations would be made so much simpler. So make it simple with RSA. Visit informationriskmanagement.com.au/riskybusiness.
It's time for this week's feature interview, and today we'll be talking all about distributed denial of service attacks, or more specifically, what one vendor is doing to try to stamp out these pesky attacks. Years ago, DDoS attacks were regarded as more of a nuisance than a menace. They were considered among recreational hackers as the lamest form of attack, and perhaps for this reason, not much thought seemed to go into how to prevent them. Those recreational hackers, who later formed what we call the information security industry today, were more focused on preventing data loss, not boosting availability. Now the internet is more than a cool place to host brochureware. It's turned into many companies' most important shopfront. The humble old DDoS attack is enough to scare the absolute bejesus out of many sensible CIOs. Think of companies like Jetstar, Virgin Blue, eBay, you know, online banking applications and so on. Bad news, if there's any downtime there. So we thought we'd speak to one vendor, Arbor Networks, about what it's doing to stamp them out. You see, Arbor provides technology to the telcos so they can filter their services and provide clean DDoS-proof pipes. The bad news is that sort of leaves the humble enterprise up the proverbial creek without a paddle unless they happen to purchase said clean DDoS-proof pipe from a telco that offers managed services. And yes, this podcast is sponsored by a large telco, Verizon Business, but no, that's not why we're doing this interview. It was an independent editorial decision. Arbor's country manager here in Australia, Nick Race, joined me by phone to spruik his kit. I started off by asking Nick how Arbor's technology detects botnets.
The way that typical botnets are controlled is through an IRC channel. And so detection mechanisms revolve around understanding which IRC channels botnets are instigated from. And using that information, then you can actually protect against those botnets. Arbor Technologies use something which we call fingerprints. And fingerprints are similar to antivirus signatures, but rather than being a static payload where you're looking for a known pattern, a fingerprint describes thing in a something in a behavioral sense. So we are looking for the known IRC command and control channel in the instance of botnets, and that's how we actually detect it using fingerprints. We have technologies, as I said before, both for service providers and for enterprises, and they use these fingerprints to do detection either in the telco's network or in the enterprise network. Typically, under DDoS conditions, we would see a large volume of traffic destined for a target's location, and it's the nature of botnet attacks is they can come from anywhere on the internet. And we're looking in the instance of that is we're looking at the sheer volume of attack traffic in that instance there. In the case of enterprise network, the enterprise, we actually use NetFlow information at layer 4 within the enterprise's switching and routing infrastructure. And when conversations or traffic occurs to the known botnet sites, then that is how it's detected, and then we can use mitigation techniques to stop it.
So I guess you're talking about preventing computers within the enterprise joining botnets, aren't you?
Absolutely right, yeah. So, I mean, you know, botnets can be used for a number of things. One of it, if you've got a particular zombie within an organization, then it has the ability to actually spread worms and viruses to other pieces of infrastructure within that enterprise. Or alternatively, it can be used as a source of a larger DDoS attack on an outbound sense from that enterprise.
Is most of what Arbor focuses on centered around preventing zombies at the source? Or, I mean, what can you do if you're being targeted by a botnet in a distributed denial of service attack? I mean, what does Arbor say you need to do in that case?
Yes, okay. So currently we have about 70% of the tier one telcos globally using our technology, and we have something called a fingerprint sharing alliance, such that if you have a DDoS attack instigated overseas on an Australian organization, then having the Australian telco detect and mitigate that attack within their network, they can also share the fingerprints upstream to the other countries where the telcos there are using similar technologies. And what we can do is we can actually stop the botnets at source in other countries.
Now, we're talking right there about actually stepping on the botnets in the cloud. Just say that I'm an Australian enterprise, you know, security manager,
And I'm a little bit concerned that I'm about to get hammered with a distributed denial of service attack. You know, what can people do once the attack has begun? I mean, is there any... Kit really isn't the solution, is there? Because often you're just dealing with your pipe or your processing capacity being hammered.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things you can do. Firstly, you can detect that within your own enterprise. And then what you can do is you can apply filters and ACLs at the edge of your network to stop it entering your network. But secondarily, you're right. Trying to solve a DDoS problem at the enterprise level doesn't solve the problem because the last mile is it will be overloaded. So what you need to do is you need to work with service providers who offer managed DDoS protection services. So in that instance that's there, telcos will actually offer effectively a clean pipes internet solution whereby the DDoS attack is detected within their cloud and then it is actually cleaned within their cloud and only good traffic is actually delivered to the enterprise destination. And that way, alleviating the bottleneck of that last mile.
This is a this is your selling proposition, isn't it? This is a solution that you take to your tier one telcos and say, hey, now you can start offering DDoS-proof services to your clients. Is that really what ARB is all about?
For our service provider customers, we not only provide protection for their network, but also revenue-generating opportunities for them to offer managed security services.
Why would the enterprise market invest in stuff that you guys make? I mean, what's the value to enterprise security of buying ARB kit?
The ARB enterprise equipment provides insider threat protection. So because we use NetFlow information from the existing switching and routing infrastructure within an enterprise, we actually will get to see every transaction on their network. And then what we can do is we can do anomaly detection on that traffic. So anomalies could be security anomalies such as botnets, phishing sites. So again, if an individual within an enterprise is foolish enough to click on an email that says, click here to update your banking details and it shoots off to a phishing site, then we will detect that inside the customer's enterprise network as well.
Okay. Now, just out of curiosity here, how much of your revenue comes from the telco stuff versus the enterprise stuff?
Our heritage is in the service provider space, so the majority of our revenues come from that side of the market. However, we've been in the enterprise market now for 5 years, and so that's certainly a growing area for us.
So you're doing a Juniper?
It's not unusual for infrastructure providers to start in the service provider and move into the enterprise, yeah.
Do you foresee a time in the future when, you know, really there'll be some intelligent, hardcore, application-specific integrated circuit running at 200 degrees crazy boxes spread throughout tier one telcos all over the world that will render DDoS attacks as we know them now obsolete?
So I'd like to think we're part of the way down that path already. Certainly we provide DDoS mitigation technology which runs at line rate within the telco's network such that we can deliver clean pipes to the telco's customers who wish to pay for that. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right, Nick Race, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business this week.
No, it's a pleasure.
That was ARB Network's country manager in Australia, Nick Race. It's time for this week's sponsor interview. Without the support of Verizon Business Security Solutions, formerly CyberTrust, this podcast wouldn't be possible. CyberTrust, in this podcast's early days, was a founding sponsor. We never would have got off the ground if it weren't for their help. So each week, we like to have a Verizon Business Security Solutions spokesperson on the show to discuss an issue or theme. This week, we're bringing Andrew Valentine back onto the program. He's an investigator type, you know, a forensics boffin, and he's got some very interesting things to say about the payment card industry data security standard, or PCI DSS. I guess it boils down to one thing. The bad guys have found some particularly effective ways around the protections mandated by PCI DSS. And I warn you now, the call quality on this interview leaves a bit to be desired. Sorry, but it couldn't really be helped.
We're already starting to see hacking cases where people are able to compromise credit card data from systems that are, you know, using compliant applications. That is, that they're using payment processing software, application software that does not retain card data, and that meets compliancy standards. Yet they're still able to get hacked. And you know, that to me speaks of bad guys that not only have widespread knowledge of these payment card applications, but may even have tertiary or insider knowledge of how those payment applications work.
So you think there might be a bit of a crossover between the legitimate security community and the bad guys?
Yeah, there's certainly situations out there where unless there was some sort of insider knowledge, it pains me to figure out how these bad guys will pull this stuff off. Classically speaking, with intrusion cases and data compromise cases, what you'll see is an intruder break into a network, probing around to find where sensitive data resides. And once they discover that sensitive data, you know, compromising it. But these are situations where payment card applications, you know, merchants, service organizations, aren't even retaining sensitive data at all. What you'll see is that you've got completely compliant payment applications. That guys will break in and then, you know, install sniffer tools to sniff payment card traffic as it leaves and comes into the network. So they're not actually compromising the store of credit card data. They're creating a store of data there to come back and harvest later.
Well, that was always a bit of a weakness with the sort of whole concept behind PCI DSS, wasn't it? It was all about not retaining data. But, you know, hey, if you can actually hack into a server where people are typing in their credit card information, if you can subvert that application, then you can capture that information as they type it in.
Absolutely. What you'll see a lot of the time, or what I've seen a lot of the time, is that the bad guys have specific knowledge about like backdoor user accounts that are supposed to be specific to the particular vendor of the payment card application, that kind of thing. Just sort of insider knowledge that you know, the bad guys would not have been able to have were not for some sort of connection with the legitimate side of the business.
So you're saying that these guys perhaps have way too much knowledge about the actual applications used on e-commerce sites, and that maybe the information is leaked from those vendors.
Sure, this is both e-commerce and as well as payment, you know, card present type of transactions at a, you know, a restaurant or a store or anything like that. I'd say it applies to both.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's sort of like the old skimming scam, isn't it? Where you know, you hand over your credit card at the 7-Eleven or at the restaurant or whatever it is, and they swipe your card, they steal the magstripe data, and then they
exactly right, Patrick. But I would argue that the bad guys now are able to do that en masse, not just at one, you know, convenience store, but across an entire enterprise. So if they figured out how to do it at one store, say of a chain that's got, you know, 30 or 40 locations across the world or across the country, they're able to do, like you said, a skimming scam, but across every single transaction, across every location of that particular merchant.
So I guess it really highlights the need for robust host-based intrusion detection, doesn't it? You really need to set up your tripwires and know if you've been compromised.
Well, absolutely. These types of situations, you rarely ever find, at least at a, you know, at a restaurant or a store, any kind of merchant, that there's, you know, like a host-based intrusion detection system at all. They're never there. But beyond that, I think what the onus is on the merchants and, you know, various companies to actually inventory data that's residing on their systems. People just sort of have this notion that, you know, we're running compliant applications, we're safe now, and we can kind of sit back and put our feet up on the desk.
Mm.
Sort of like a complacency. After we've installed all compliant, you know, hardware and applications, there's no need to go any further. There's no need to kind of to stay up to par. And I think it's that lackadaisical attitude that allows the bad guys to kind of pull off what they pull off.
But doesn't PCI almost encourage that sort of attitude by saying, well, here are the 12 commandments, and if you follow these, you're okay?
I would argue that it did if it weren't for the 12th commandment, which has to do with security awareness and security updates. All throughout number 12 on PCI, there are directives around making sure that all employees in an organization are up to date on not just the notions and principles behind information security, but to stay up to date on changes, you know, within information security philosophy.
But doesn't that seem like a really big 12th step? Like, you've got, you know, step number one, thou shalt install antivirus. Step number two, thou shalt use compliant applications. And then, you know, step number 12 seems to be, and thou shalt know exactly what's going on in the InfoSec industry and train all your staff. It just seems like a much bigger requirement than any of the other little steps.
Yes, I would certainly argue that the need to maintain sort of awareness and knowledge of the issues is, at least in the realm of the PCI requirements, it's not an afterthought, certainly not a priority. But as you know, the thing about technology is it changes. What, you know, what was secure yesterday is not going to be secure tomorrow. And what you think is not retaining card data or any kind of sensitive information today will very likely be retaining it tomorrow or And PCI, although it changes, we're on the second version of the PCI standards now. That document set doesn't change as quickly as the technology and the threats change. It's absolutely true.
Do you think that's what we need to do? We need an updated PCI DSS, or I mean, wherein lies the solution to this subversion of PCI's effectiveness?
I would think that PCI itself is hugely effective if merchants and service providers take it seriously. I think that a lot of the time organizations sort of treat it as they sheepishly say, oh, okay, fine, we'll do this just so that we can, keep our payment card transactions in line. Well, fine, we'll do this. Nobody embraces it. The people that don't embrace it and don't implement it sort of with full force are the ones that sort of fall behind. The attitude that it's never going to happen to me, I think, is what is the driving force behind the failures. Every single person you find or organization you find that's been hacked, you invariably say that, man, it was never going to happen to me. How could this ever happen to our organization?
Yeah, I guess it's that same old chestnut. Andrew Valentine, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
That was Verizon Business Security Solutions' Andrew Valentine there, rounding out this edition of A Risky Business. Don't forget to check out itradio.com.au's other show, A Series of Tubes with Ian Yates. It's more about networking and general IT than security, but it's well worth a listen, and we hope you'll tune in. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.